From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with writer Nicholas Prophet. Francis Coppola's new film, Gardens of Stone, is adapted from Prophet's novel of the same name. It's based on Prophet's tour of duty in the Army, where he served on the burial detail at Arlington National Cemetery. Also today, I talk with actor Werner Klemperer. He's best known as Colonel Klink from the TV sitcom Hogan's Heroes. Klemperer is now co-starring with Joel Grey in a revival of the musical Cabaret. Our jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a reissue of Dizzy Gillespie sessions from the 1940s, and TV critic David Bianculli gives his surefire ways to avoid the tube's worst. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is writer Nicholas Prophet. Prophet's 1983 novel, Gardens of Stone, is the basis of the new film of the same name, directed by Francis Coppola. The movie Gardens of Stone stars James Caan, Angelica Houston, and James Earl Jones. The story is a semi-autobiographical account of Prophet's experiences with the military and the Vietnam War. From 1961 to 64, Prophet served on the Old Guard, an elite Army ceremonial unit attached to Arlington National Cemetery. He was part of the pageantry with which old soldiers are buried. Prophet arrived in Vietnam in the early 70s as a correspondent for Newsweek. Like the film, Prophet's novel traces the division the war caused on the home front. I asked Nicholas Prophet if he got the call of a lifetime from Coppola, telling him he wanted to make Gardens of Stone into a film.
Well, I found out very indirectly. At first, the word I got was that it was going to be done by, I've forgotten his
name.
One of the other guys. The guy who did Out of Africa, Sidney Pollack.
Oh, yeah.
Which didn't disturb me much either. He's a fine director, too. But if I could have hand-picked a director to handle my book, it would have been Coppola.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that his other Vietnam War novel is the epic Apocalypse Now. And this movie is, it also concerns the Vietnam War, but it takes place in the Washington, D.C. area. And it's people in the Old Guard on burial detail. It's the exact opposite perspective. An Apocalypse Now. There's no fighting in it. And it's also very sympathetic to the military.
Yes, it is. It's not very sympathetic to the Vietnam War, but it is sympathetic to the military.
To the soldiers.
To the soldiers, and especially sergeants, the non-coms, the so-called lifers, who came in for a lot of abuse in most of the Vietnam treatments. That comes out of my own background. My father was a career Army sergeant, and I went into the Army and spent 3 years in it before I went to college. And I ended up a sergeant, buck sergeant, a low one. But so I've had this fascination with and association with the Army all of my life, and I thought that that was a side of things that hadn't been told before. I especially wanted to look at the institution of the Army and get across the idea of the Army as a family and take a look at what the war did to the institution of the Army.
When you found out that Coppola wanted to buy the rights to your book, were you able to find out what it was that attracted him to your book?
I'm not really sure. I haven't really talked with him about it. I think the rituals, it's a book full of rituals, and Coppola's previous work has always had a strong emphasis on rituals, the Godfather movies, for instance, male bonding between my protagonists, that sort of thing has also interested him. He's a very family-oriented director. He's got a very strong sense of family, I know, both in his personal life and in his vision as a director. And I think the elements of family, of the Army as family, and of these people coming together as family members who aren't really related by blood, appealed to him. But I'm guessing for him. I don't really know, but that's what I suspect.
Let's talk about the part of your life that your novel, Gardens of Stone, and the film Gardens of Stone is based on. It's loosely biographical, autobiographical.
Loosely, right.
So you, in 1961 to 64, served in the Old Guard. Now, what is the Old Guard? Most of us have seen it, but I never actually identified it as the Old Guard before.
No, it's those background people you see in shots of the president when his plane lands or at a White House ceremony. They're the guys standing in the background holding flags or standing at attention. It's basically a ceremonial battalion. part of the 3rd Infantry. It's one battalion of the 3rd Infantry. It's stationed at Fort Myer, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac from Washington. And it does many, many different jobs, everything from putting together a color guard in old powdered wigs and colonial uniforms out at Mount Vernon, to guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, to providing escort platoons for the president when he arrives at an airport or takes off from Washington, to greet heads of state that are coming in. But basically their job is to bury people at Arlington Cemetery to render the final military honors.
Do you have to do the digging when you're in the old guard?
No.
Just the ceremony part.
Just the ceremonial part. And even that's broken down. There are firing party teams, and those are the guys that give the 21-gun salutes. And there are casket bearer teams, and their job is to carry coffins. There's a caisson section which handles the horses that are used in the ceremonies. And then there are just marchers who march along as an armed escort.
Were you glad that while you were in the military, your service was in the old guard?
No. I mean, I thought it's a very spit and polish outfit. A haircut every other day, shaving 3 times a day, shining shoes all the time, uniforms pressed all the time. You couldn't even wear your shoes inside your barracks. You had to go in stocking feet because you might mess up the floor. You had to be ready for inspection all the time. And that kind of thing I thought was rather Mickey Mouse and didn't appeal to me greatly. I was really out of the service before the Vietnam War really got started. As I say, I got out in 64 and the buildup in Vietnam started in 65. So when I wrote the book, I advanced the time a bit because I wanted to get the Vietnam thing in. I wanted to use Arlington Cemetery as a metaphor for Vietnam, as a final resting place for our casualties. And if I had been in the old guard doing those kinds of things during the height of the fighting, like the people in the book and in the movie are, I don't really know how I'd have felt about it. It seems kind of silly to be doing that sort of thing when people are dying 10,000 miles away.
In the movie, one of the sergeants says to one of the young men just arriving, "Welcome to show business."
Right.
Because there's so much ceremony and so much emphasis on clothing. And somebody else says that the old guard is the kabuki theater of American arms. Now, was there a lot of sarcastic comments like that when you arrived?
There were, because there are a bunch of, there's always sarcastic comments from young soldiers, no matter what they're doing and where they are. There was a lot of toy soldiers talk. But at the same time, I think almost every man in that unit knew that the requirements to be accepted were quite strict. You had to have a certain military bearing. You had to be a certain height. I was very surprised that I was accepted into it simply because I wear glasses. And today, that's not really a hindrance. If you wear glasses and you're assigned to that unit, they issue you contact lenses and pay for it. But at that time, I don't even think contact lenses had been invented yet. But I wore glasses, and as a result, did not get to do any of the high visibility things like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or casket bearers. I was always in an honor platoon, and more often than not, in the back rank where you couldn't see me very well.
My guest is novelist Nicholas Prophet, and his novel Gardens of Stone has just been made into a movie. The military is usually seen as a testing ground for young men to prove their manhood. And I wonder if being in such a ceremonial position as the old guard made you feel like, well, I'm not really going to get to prove my manhood here, because what we have to do is spit polish our shoes and dress sharp and be immaculate. It's the kind of thing that's looked at as being very fey by men who want to prove their manhood.
Well, there wasn't really a hot war going on at the time. There were some crises. While I was there, there was the Berlin Wall crisis to begin with, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a lot of anticipation and jumpiness and uneasiness about what could happen, but nothing actually really did happen. And we did have some advisors in Vietnam. In fact, most of the officers and senior NCOs in the old guard had been in Vietnam as advisors, early advisors in the early 1960s, 61, 62, that sort of thing. And the honor guard was, I guess, their reward for faithful service in Vietnam. It was seen as a very high profile post where a man should be feel honored to be there. Number one for the officers, and it was, you were not very far from the Pentagon and could sort of keep an eye on your career at close hand, and who knows, maybe even meet somebody who could influence it. So it was a prestigious posting.
You wanted to be in the military because your father had been, and you wanted to carry on the line?
I had the idea originally of perhaps even making it a career, and my 3 years in the service cured me of that. I've had this love affair with the Army all of my life, except for the 3 years I was actually in it.
One of the characters in your novel really wants to go out to the front in Vietnam, and of course his senior officers keep telling him there is no front in that particular war. Did you ever want to, I know there wasn't a war raging at the time, but were you frustrated by that?
No, not really. I was never quite as naive or as gung-ho as that young character in the book. He's almost too naive, a caricature of all that martial feeling that young men have, which is countered by voices of experience who've actually been there. No, I didn't really have. The very thought of combat made me a little nervous. And when I got to Vietnam as a reporter and had my fair share of shooting fracases, I didn't like it very much.
Hey, before we talk about your experiences reporting in Vietnam, I want to talk a little bit about your reaction to the movie that's based on your book. Now, you've had the opportunity to see it how many times?
I've seen it 3 times.
So what did you think of the movie?
I'm not really sure, Terry. It's I'm so close to the material. The first time, I wasn't very pleased. That was my overall reaction. I was basically looking for the changes and where they changed the material around, and I didn't see it very clearly. The second time I saw it, I liked it better. And the third time I saw it, I liked it even better. So another 4 or 5 viewings, and I'll consider it a masterpiece, I'm sure.
That's right. But, keep going, and it'll be
that's
great.
That's right. Most people, if you haven't read the book, then you just go see the movie, and you judge it as a film. If you have read the book, then you've got different things to balance off against each other. If you've written the book, you really have a lot of baggage that you're bringing into the theater with you. So I'm not sure. As I say, I like it better each time I see it. And I really appreciate a couple of performances, and I think both James Caan and James Earl Jones are superb in it. I've never seen them better.
Did you want to know, who's playing me?
There wasn't really a me. There was one me was me at sort of 19 years old, and another me was me at 40. The casting, I wasn't quite sure about the casting. James Caan hasn't made a movie in 5 or 6 years, and he came out of retirement for this. He really wanted that role, and I think I know why now, because he just disappears in that role. You don't really think that you're seeing James. You don't think about James Caan being up there. They came very close a couple of times to signing Paul Newman to play that role, and Paul Newman is a very fine actor, but I, for one, can never watch him on the screen without somewhere in the back of my mind saying, that's Paul Newman. Caan, there is no sense of this is James Caan playing a role. This is he just disappeared into it.
You know, I don't think we've really explained what the story of your novel is about. Do you want to do that?
Oh, my gosh. It's a young man, a young soldier, whose father was in the military, reports to the ceremonial unit in Washington, and is taken under the wing of a couple of older experienced sergeants who were friends of his father, and they sort of shepherd him. Well, he's very anxious to get on with his career and get to Vietnam, as it's the middle of the Vietnam War. He'd rather be fighting it instead of burying its casualties, which is what the job consists of. The two older men are cautioning him and trying to slow him down and give him some sort of sense of reality. They've both been in Vietnam as advisors before, and trying to give him a sense of things not going right over there. They already have a premonition about what Vietnam is doing to the country, and more important to them, what it's doing to the Army. It's tearing their Army apart. And they consider the Army their family, and it's a family affair, and they don't like to see their family in trouble. And they befriend this young man. He learns some things and doesn't learn other things, and finally goes off to war.
We'll talk more about your movie in a couple of seconds. We're going to take a very short break here. And my guest is writer Nicholas Prophet. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Nicholas Prophet. His first novel, Gardens of Stone, is the basis of a new film of the same name, directed by Francis Coppola. The story is based on Prophet's tour of duty in the Old Guard. He served on burial detail at Arlington National Cemetery. During the 70s, he reported for Newsweek. From 71 to 72, he reported from Vietnam. He returned there to cover the fall of Saigon. You know, one of the things in the story of Gardens of Stone is that the soldiers who are on burial detail all the time, as you were, their attitude towards the people who they're burying changes as they start to realize that it's them. You know, it's people like them. It's people who they know. Did you go through anything like that yourself? And I wonder what it's like to preside over burials of people who are totally anonymous to you. And it's a ritual you perform day after day. It's like theater, really.
You went through the first funeral was a very moving and shattering experience, and terribly poignant. In fact, I think tears came to my eyes the first funeral I pulled. There's the full panoply of ceremony and the rendering of taps and the black stallion with the boots backwards in the stirrups and the rat-tat-tat of the drum. It's very moving. By the time you've done your 100th, tend to become a little irreverent toward the whole process. The Old Guard, we called burials drop jobs. We called the cemetery itself either the boneyard or the garden. And we were burying 12, 13, 14 people a day. I wasn't around to bury people when the war was going on, although my characters in the book are. I don't know what I would have felt if the people we were burying were our age. Most of the people that I was burying as an 18, 19-year-old in 1961 and 62 were older men. They were colonels and captains and sergeants, men who had done 20 or 30 years and had died from natural causes brought on by the kinds of illnesses that older people are prone to. I don't know what the reaction would have been if the casualties had been 19-year-olds just like myself who had been killed in a war while I was in a very cushy post stateside and these kids were over in Vietnam. I also remember the first time we used to bury infants too, children of military personnel, where normally there are eight men on a casket as a casket burying team. And when you've got a coffin a foot or 2 feet long with an infant in it, That was rather sad too, but when you first started doing it, it was a very poignant, moving ceremony. As you kept doing more and more and more, you became more and more cynical about the whole thing, and you made up little ditties and irreverent remarks that you were careful not to let the next of kin hear. But
what kind of ditties?
I don't know.
Fit or not?
No, no.
Okay. Well, you know, it's. It's one of those really ugly ironies that while this movie was being filmed about people on burial duty, that the director, Francis Coppola's son, was actually killed in, I think it was a boating accident.
Freak boating accident, yes.
And I can't imagine what it was to film the rest of the movie after that happened.
Especially, yes. I was on the set a few days after that tragedy, and it was a very somber set, of course. I had expected maybe that Coppola would have shut down production for a while. Instead, he took off a day. They had a very nice service for his son at the Fort Myer Chapel, with the entire old guard in attendance, and then he went right back to work and worked around the clock for a week, and then sort of had a little collapse, went into an army hospital for a couple of days, rested up, got plenty of fluids, whatever, came right back and started right in again. It became a testimonial to his son. But it must have been very, very difficult for him to, number one, losing a child is probably the worst thing that can happen to a person. And then to be spending your days following that, surrounded by gravestones and filming funeral scenes, it must have been very, very difficult.
In your life, you were in the military before the Vietnam War escalated, but when you finally got to Vietnam, it wasn't as part of the military. It was as a reporter.
Right.
What was your position on the war by the time you got there for Newsweek?
The position of my generation in general was that the war was a mistake, that it wasn't working out. I think it was fairly obvious by that time. I went to Vietnam with the idea of being an objective reporter and making my own decisions, but I think I was predisposed to thinking that the war was a colossal mistake, a misadventure for our country. When I left 2 years later, I had not changed my mind at all. I still thought it was a colossal mistake. I think that the way I got to my decision was a little different than before. For instance, I had a great deal of respect for the American fighting man and for the kids that were over there and what they had to go through. Not very much respect for the politicians and some of the higher brass involved.
You know, you were describing Gardens of Stone as, in a way, being about the military as family and the ruptures in that family that were caused by the war. Your father was a career military man, and I imagine there were probably ruptures in your family when you were against the war, especially when you were reporting from Vietnam.
Not really. I avoided all that
by being in Vietnam?
No, by having my father die on me. He died.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, he died in 63. I remember it very clearly because I was home for his funeral when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I got called by my unit off of my father's funeral. He had been buried, but I was still helping my mother do some administrative things, and I got called away because they needed every available body to back at Arlington to participate in the state funeral for JFK. They hadn't pulled a state funeral like that for many years, so they were blowing dust off the procedure books and panicking, running around panicking. So in a way, I'm almost glad he didn't live to see it. He loved the Army very much. He was a veteran of World War II and of Korea. And I don't think he could have taken what the Army went through in Vietnam.
When you were reporting in Vietnam, did you spend a lot of time thanking your lucky stars that you were there as a reporter and not in the military?
Yes, of course. I spent a lot of time out in the field with the troops. And part of my job is actually go looking for trouble. I probably saw as much, if not more, combat than the average GI who was over there. But I never forgot that I had that option to get out, to bug out any time I wanted to. And I exercised that option a couple of times where I thought that this was a no-survivor situation and caught that last resupply helicopter out. And I felt badly about it, but not badly enough to stay. And one time when I left, there were about 15 people left, and they were all killed. And if I had stayed, I'd have died.
Were they all reporters?
No, they were all soldiers. And I'd gotten out on the last resupply helicopter.
Did your military training come in handy as a reporter?
Not much. I did not, as a matter of principle, carry a weapon. I was a reporter, not a combatant. I had some trouble with some of the units I went out with. They didn't want to carry me along unless I armed myself, and I just refused. And usually talked them into letting me come along anyway. It helped a little bit. It certainly helped in my reporting, yes. I knew some basics about strategy and tactics and small unit maneuvers and that sort of thing. So it did help.
When you were reporting for Newsweek, you were already opposed to the war. Did you have any editorial problems with what you were reporting? A lot of people back in the States, you know, hadn't been there and didn't.
No, I mean, when I don't want to leave the impression that I was going to slant that reporting to fit my bias. I had a mild basic bias when I went over there that the war was a mistake. Nothing I saw while I was over there led me to think any differently. If I had found evidence to the contrary, I'd have changed my mind. I did change my mind but I did not agree with some of my friends. When I'd left the States, a lot of my friends gave no credit at all to the troops who were over there. They were baby killers and this and that. I had a lot of arguments when I came back with those kind of people. I wouldn't listen to that kind of talk. It was nonsense.
You spent over a decade as a reporter, about 4 years in the military, and now you're basically a full-time novelist, and you're doing well enough at it to remain a full-time novelist. Why do you want to be a novelist as opposed to writing nonfiction or continuing reporting?
I always felt that the canvas, the reporter's canvas, was a little too small for me. You had to be a successful foreign correspondent, which I spent 10 years abroad, and that's what I did, was report mostly wars and coups and earthquakes and third world disasters and that sort of thing. When I found something that interested me, my personal inclination was to stick around and look at it for 6 months and study it from all angles and really get it down. And when you're a foreign correspondent, there's just not time for that. You come in, bang, 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 do the story. Wrap it up, become an instant expert in 48 hours, write a story that sounds as if you've lived there all your life when you hardly really know what you're talking about, then move on to the next trouble spot. And there was never an opportunity to actually light anywhere and really get to the bottom of things. As a novelist, I can do that. I can make that canvas as large as I want. I can tell the whole story. I actually truly believe that through fiction you can get a lot closer to the truth than you can through nonfiction.
Well, I wish you the best with your writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for visiting with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been writer Nicholas Prophet. His novel Gardens of Stone is the basis of the current film Gardens of Stone, directed by Francis Coppola. This is Fresh Air. On the next program, I'll speak with diva Jesse Norman, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with actor Werner Klemperer. He's currently touring the country with Joel Grey in a revival of the musical Cabaret. It's a far cry from one of his earlier roles, the continually outsmarted Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes. Also today, jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a reissue of Dizzy Gillespie's small group and big band recordings of the 1940s. TV critic David Bianculli explains how to tell a bad TV show without even turning on the set. And we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. We have our weekly jazz review now with music critic Francis Davis. Bebop is the cornerstone of modern jazz, and trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie was one of its architects. Francis has a review of a new reissue of Dizzy Gillespie's big band and small group sessions from the 1940s.
Conventional wisdom equates swing with big bands and bop with small groups, but nothing's that simple. At least two big bands were playing bop before anyone thought to call it that. The first was the Earl Hines Orchestra in 1943, when its personnel included Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. But unfortunately, this edition of Hines's orchestra never recorded. A year later, Gillespie and Parker were reunited in the Billy Eckstein Orchestra. This band did record, but Eckstein's popularity as a crooner dictated ballads and blues, not bop. So record buyers had to wait until 1946 for their first taste of big band bop. That's when Gillespie formed his own orchestra. Dizziest, a new two-record set on RCA Bluebird, focuses on Gillespie's activities from 1946 to 1949. It's not quite the definitive reissue one might have hoped for. It unaccountably omits two dazzling performances by the 1949 Metronome All-Stars with Gillespie, Parker, and a host of others. But all 28 of the big band sides that Gillespie made for RCA are here. So are four titles from a justly celebrated 1946 small group date with Don Byas and Milt Jackson. But it's the big band stuff that fascinates me. The Gillespie Orchestra allayed suspicions that bop was an aberration, a music suitable only for the mavericks who had originated it. The numerous journeymen who passed through the band's ranks proved that there was no shortage of musicians committed to bop. Equally important, the band established that there were numerous composers and arrangers capable of orchestrating bop for large ensemble. The notable contributors to the band's book included Tad Dameron, Walter Fuller, Gerald Wilson, John Lewis, and Gillespie himself, all of whom are well represented on Dizziest. But the chart that represents the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra at its peak is a two-part work, called Cubano B and Cubano Bop. It's jointly credited to Gillespie and George Russell, but it's Russell's sensibility which prevails. With Cubano B and Cubano Bop, both recorded in 1947, Russell introduced jazz to such advanced concepts as modality and bitonality. On a more elementary but no less satisfying level, these works represent as imaginative a synthesis of jazz and Afro-Cuban rhythms as one is ever likely to hear. Thanks in no small part to Chano Pozo's soul-stirring chanting and drumming toward the very beginning of Cubano Bop, which we're going to listen to right now. Kiki! Kiki!
Simba! 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 Cubanobi! Cubanoba! Cubanobi! Cubanoba! Cubanobi! Cubanoba! Cubanobi! Cubanoba! Cubanobi! Cubanoba! Cubanobi! Cubanoba!
George Russell and Dizzy Gillespie's Cabana Bop, the second half of a two-part work that must have sounded visionary in 1947. It still does. Not everything on Dizzyist lives up to the superlative. For example, there are inane novelty tunes that Gillespie recorded in a futile attempt to seduce the masses. The title, Hey Pete, Let's Eat Mo' Meat, should give you some idea of what I'm talking about. But even these tracks have undeniable period charm. For that matter, so do the moony vocals of Johnny Hartman, a great ballad singer, but he hadn't yet hit his stride when he worked with Gillespie. When a collection similar to this one was released in Europe about 10 years ago, a British reviewer recommended purchasing it, even if that meant going without eating. One hesitates to make such a statement, even in jest, in 1987, when so many people are, in fact, going without such basic necessities as food and shelter. But suffice it to say, Dizzyist is one of those items that belongs in every jazz record collection. Without it, you're missing an essential chapter in the story of bop.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is actor Werner Klemperer. He became famous for his portrayal of Colonel Klink in the TV sitcom Hogan's Heroes. Klemperer played the bumbling Nazi commander of a prisoner of war camp during World War II. Now Klemperer is co-starring as a Jew during the rise of the Nazis in Berlin in a revival of the musical Cabaret. It's headed for Broadway, and like the original production, it stars Joel Grey.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome, fremde, étranger, stranger.
Cabaret was first staged in 1966 and was adapted into a film in 1972. In the theater revival, Klemperer plays Herr Schultz, an aging Jewish man in love with his Gentile landlady. This storyline was cut from the film. Klemperer grew up in Berlin, where Cabaret is set. His father was the Jewish-born orchestra conductor Otto Klemperer. The family fled Germany in 1933 and eventually settled in Los Angeles. I asked Werner Klemperer if audiences who know him as Colonel Klink will be surprised by his performance in Cabaret.
Well, I think I certainly am showing a different side of me as opposed to Colonel Klink in Hogan's Heroes, and in some ways a different side of me with some of the rather harsh and villainous parts I've played, but I don't think it's something that's that foreign to me. It's a great joy to do it because the part is truly sympathetic, and an actor always loves to do that. And also, I had a chance to sing, which is not my specialty, although I've done a little of it. And for me to have an opportunity to work on Broadway, also singing meant something to me.
I really enjoyed your singing very much, and you seem to really sing from the heart. And I
also—that's so nice of you to say, because I have great, I don't feel very secure about that part of my work, because that's not, you know, what I've done so much. And I'm glad to hear somebody tells me it was good.
You lived in Germany during the period that Cabaret is set, and your family fled Germany after Hitler was elected chancellor. Is this a very personal role for you?
I give you one example, and that might make it clear to you. In this show, as you remember, in the last scene that I'm involved in, when I say goodbye to the younger couple and tell them that I am moving from one apartment to another to be further away from Fräulein Schneider, the woman that has decided not to marry me. I mentioned the name of a place, a square in Berlin, where this apartment is that I'm going to. Well, I hate to tell you this, but it's the truth. Our family lived 200 yards away from that place. And every time I have to say that name of that place, I have shivers up and down my spine because I had to go through that square to go to school every morning. I went to grammar school at that time. So that brings everything very much into focus for me.
Do you have memories of Hitler coming to power? Do you
Yes, I have memories as a child about the excitement of the city, about some of the young SA men running around the street, throwing bricks into Jewish stores and creating turmoil everywhere, and the police having fights with them, and that sort of thing. I have those kind of images, but nothing more than that, really.
So you were really very young when your family fled the country, and you couldn't really understand the political ramifications and the
well, I understood
ramifications of what was happening.
To some degree, because my father and mother made sure that we children were kept somewhat knowledgeable about what was happening, but I didn't really realize the heaviness of the situation. The interesting part is, you know, that many of our friends and acquaintances, many of the Jewish faith, didn't think, as many German Jews did not think, that this was going to last, this was going to be a passing phase, as the character that I play says. And they just sort of put blinders on and said, this is ridiculous, there'll be another regime soon and everything will be fine and I must stay with my country. And that, of course, the rest is history.
So you and your family moved to Los Angeles.
Well, eventually. We were in Vienna, Austria for a couple of years, but then we moved to Los Angeles because my dad was offered the post of the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
We had talked before about, well, I had mentioned how much I enjoyed your singing.
You're making my day. Just keep saying that.
Did you sing a lot when you were young? I'm thinking, you know, it's an obvious thing to think
no,
about that with your
no,
father being
I never,
a great conductor.
I've never had a singing lesson in my life, but I have appeared as an actor, singer in a couple of other musicals, and, you know, I've done a little singing, and I do it, but it's not... I really don't treat it as something that, you know, I have to really work on, and I don't want to, because I think if I don't think about any technique or anything like that, and just let it come from the inside, it's going to come all right, you know, and be okay.
If my father were a famous conductor, I'd be afraid to sing unless I thought I was singing absolutely brilliantly, because there'd be so much to measure up to.
Well, I would suspect that if my father were alive today and he were coming to see this performance, I'd have a certain sense of nervousness too.
Right. I'm listening to your voice, and you don't really sound like you have much of a German accent. I guess you moved
well,
young enough to...
Well, I work... It depends on how I concentrate. Now, I'm not... I'm reasonably relaxed with you, and I am trying to just speak as straight as I can. There are times when it creeps in more. There are other times when I can lose it completely if I really have to force myself.
For a man with a German accent... Were your roles at the beginning of your career limited?
Stereotyped. But
yeah.
Then it changed. And also you have to remember, if you, in this business, particularly in the motion picture and film industry, if you have an accent, they give you foreign roles, not necessarily of one country. And you just change the accent a little bit so I could play. I've played Frenchmen. I played villains in almost any country you want to think of. You know, before Hogan's Heroes, I used to be a heavy in a lot in television. Nobody knew my name, but I played heavies all over the place.
When you were first offered the role of Colonel Klink in Hogan's Heroes, what did you think of this idea for a TV series,
well,
like a sitcom
the
about
reason,
a
no,
German
No, no, let me explain
camp?
To you. When I was offered this role, I wasn't offered it in the first place. I was just called to meet with a producer and my agent. I'll never forget this. If I live to be 1,000 years old, called me up and said, "You, I have an interview for you for a half-hour show in which they are looking for the commandant of a POW camp in World War II." I said, "Fine." That's all he said. He never mentioned comedy. He just and I'd been playing some of those kind of roles straight and serious. So I went to the interview. met the producer, sat down and talked to him, and he said, you know, this is a comedy. And I thought for a minute the guy was, you know, kidding me. And then he shoved some pieces of paper in front of me that was a couple of scenes that had been written already for the pilot. And I looked at it, and it began to look quite clever, and I began to be more interested. The material was very persuasive because it was very cleverly done, and it was very satirical, and it appealed to me. I made one, when they offered me the role, I made one stipulation to the producer. I said, if in any of the segments the character of Colonel Klink wins out in the end, I will not be with this show anymore. And that was the end of that. Well, he never won out anyway. It wasn't written that way.
You said before that you usually performed in the role of the heavy.
Yes.
You played a lot of villain roles during your career.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Why were you cast as villain so much?
I don't know. I guess I have one of those faces. I don't know. I really can't tell you that. It just started. And then, of course, if something starts and you do it in Hollywood, they grab onto it, you know. And I was just the heavy a lot.
Well, I really feel that seeing you in Cabaret has introduced me to a new side of you as a performer. How do you expect that this production is going to change your career?
Well, I have no idea how it's going to change my career, and I think my career has been reasonably, to me, satisfactory. Everything I do, however different it is meaningful to me, and I look at it as a new challenge that I like to deal with, fulfill if I can, and get on to the next thing. So I don't think so much about what will it add to my career, because for me, a job is a job is a job.
Werner Klemperer plays Herr Schultz in the new production of the musical Cabaret. Cabaret is currently in San Francisco until June 14th. The tour continues to Los Angeles, Costa Mesa, California, and Houston before arriving on Broadway in October. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Terry.
What stories do you have for us on this holiday?
Well, today we mostly consider Memorial Day. I spent the early part of the afternoon over a hot outdoor grill to bring you tips on barbecuing from food writer Leslie Bloom. We have a roundup of what's doing around the country. A Chicago neighborhood celebrates with a people's parade. No floats, no marching bands, and really no one watching from the sidelines. Everyone's in the parade. We also go to Buford, South Carolina. They call it Decoration Day down there. And the stories of five black servicemen. They remember Vietnam.
Thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today's savvy TV viewers pride themselves on their ability to predict which shows will be truly awful. Now, with the help of our TV critic David Bianculli, this is a skill we can all master.
Anyone who saw Green Acres knows it wasn't one of TV's finest hours or half hours, but there was a way to know that without ever seeing an episode, thanks to the 10 early warning signs of bad TV. One of the few advantages a TV show has over a book is that you can judge a TV show by its cover, or at least by its title. By watching out for a few key words or phrases, you can save yourself from exposure to those shows that would, after you've seen them, make you want to scream or shower. These warning signs are like mathematical theorems and are occasionally changed when contrary evidence presents itself. Green Acres, for example, would at one time have been identified by the rule that said, beware of shows with colors in their title. That rule worked just fine in the days of Red Fox, Green Hornet, and Pink Lady, but it was made obsolete by The White Shadow, 10 Speed and Brown Shoe, and Hill Street Blues. But just as surely as there are new shows to replace the old, there are new rules to replace the old. Here's a current list of the 10 early warning signs of bad TV. Enjoy them and employ them. Rule 1. Avoid all shows that abuse spelling or grammar. This rule protects viewers from Gimme a Break and the recently revived Me and Mrs. C. In the past, it nailed down such putrid programs as Different Strokes, which was spelled without an E, and We Got It Made, which was made without a brain. Rule 2. Shows that call themselves amazing aren't. Amazing stories should have been titled Marginally Interesting Stories. And who remembers The Amazing Dunninger, The Amazing Polgar, The Amazing Spider-Man? Amazing. Rule 3. Shows with new in the title are not improved. That means skip the new Mike Hammer and the new Gidget and any other show that follows in the tradition of the new Adventures of Perry Mason or the new Christie Minstrels. It's okay to apply this rule to all game shows, including the Newlywed Game, but don't get carried away and avoid Newhart. Rule 4. If a show changes its title, change the channel. Here's another reason to skip the new Mike Hammer, which used to be called, I don't know, the old Mike Hammer. It also applies to Nothing Is Easy, which used to be Together We Stand. If the product's good, the label won't change. Rule 5. See if you can guess the next rule by listening to this audio daily double. Right. Those themes were all from shows with numbers in their title. Hawaii 5-0, Route 66, 77 Sunset Strip. Rule number 5 is, numbers don't add up to much. The exception is 60 minutes, but otherwise the rule warns against such shows as 2020, West 57th, 227, and Take 5. It also predicted the demise of 1986, the show, not the year. Rule 6. Spin away from spin-offs. The Tortellis was such an inferior spin-off of Cheers that it should have been called Booze, spelled with an S, not a Z-E. And the same rule will apply probably next year to the Lisa Bonet spinoff of The Cosby Show. Rule 7. Beware of exclamation points. This means shows like Gimme a Break and Sledgehammer. And That's Incredible, if you remember that. Excitement in the title means no excitement in the show. Stay away from these. This means you. Rule 8. Never watch anything with an Osmond in it. This rule is self-explanatory and has no exceptions. Rule 9. Question all question marks. For several seasons now, the correct answer to any question posed in a show's title has been total apathy. What really happened to the class of 65? Who cares? Who done it? Who cares? Who's the boss? Who cares? You again? Not me. Rule 10. If a show changes addresses, don't follow. There are a few welcome exceptions to this rule, but in most cases, a move to another network means a drop in quality. This is true of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which was canceled by NBC, but is alive barely on the USA Network. Most TV shows were bad enough when they're fresh. Who needs leftovers?
David Bianculli is the television critic for the New York Post. Here's a preview of our next show. On our next program, I'll speak with award-winning obituary writer Jim Nicholson. He takes an unconventional approach to this standard newspaper feature. He overlooks the famous, preferring to celebrate the lives of janitors, cab drivers, and bartenders. Rock historian Ed Ward will recall the Beatles' competition when they were one of many up-and-coming bands in Liverpool. And book critic John Leonard will review Waltzing with a Dictator by former New York Times reporter Raymond Bonner. It traces America's involvement with the Marcos regime in the Philippines. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.